Penguin Radio 102.3 FM, San Rafael, or radio.dominican.edu. I am your host, Barbara McVeigh. We got big things to talk about here on Take Back, and we have an agenda. As our planet faces global climate change, melting polar ice caps, and ocean acidification, we like to remain positive because there's hope. We're still alive here at Take Back. We try to get deep into understanding these issues and ask big questions about what does it mean to be human and where are we going wrong on planet Earth. Here on Take Back, we'll have thinkers, poets, writers, educators, musicians, environmentalists, and risk takers. Help us get it right and navigate this crazy journey called life. Maybe we'll get inspired to make some big changes and look at who we have been and why. Today on Take Back, we're talking about education, one of my favorite subjects. Our public school system is under attack. And is that attack justified? Let's find out. Our guest today is Dennis Ian, a retired school teacher. He taught for 34 years, and he's become an international writer telling us why we don't have it right anymore, and he's trying to fill us in with some of his thoughts and ideas. He joins me by phone from New York. Hi, Ian. Dennis Ian. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Good afternoon.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us. I really want to hear about what you're up to. I know I've been able to take pleasure in a number of your articles, and you've got some pretty strong opinions about what you've been seeing with our public school education.
Well, I retired from teaching about 10 years ago, and since that time, I became involved in the anti-Common Core movement. It was actually Yvonne Gasparino of New York that first got me involved. She and her husband run the Stop Common Core in New York website. And so I tumbled into this. This was not meant to become a second career. It just seemed to evolve. And one of the skills, I guess, that played into this was the fact that I could express myself in the written way. And I started writing various articles and whatnot. And before I know it, they were picked up by some important websites. And now it seems that I don't know, I've become a little bit popular. And not only here, but, you know, outside, down in Australia and New Zealand, because this whole reform movement in education is actually taking place in the United Kingdom, as well as here in the United States, and of course, and then down in places like Australia and New Zealand. So I tumbled into this all by accident.
Wow, you've been, one of the quotes that I read in one of your articles, these spring months in turn children into school loathing messes because of fraudy gurus insist that grit and rigor are imperative antidotes to wasteful childhoods of discovery and play. Wow, that's pretty darn powerful. What's happening to our children? What is this about grit and rigor, and are they losing out on discovery and play? Why is that important?
I don't know why it's important, and to be honest with you, I keep wondering where these new theories all evolve from, where they come from. Who are these gurus who suddenly make a decision that, you know, 60-month-old children need rigor and grit as part of their recipe of education? I don't understand how these developments all come about, not only just grit and rigor, but things like, well, now, music and art are less important, and recess is a waste of time, and all of a sudden testing is a more natural, you know, god in terms of education. I don't know where these people get their purchase, where they get their acceptance, and how they're pushed forward, and suddenly it's taken as a fact that these are essentials of education. I don't understand why eighth graders have to be evaluated yearly more rigorously than people taking a bar exam.
If I can add to that, and I'm going to be inserting some of my thoughts in this, because so much of what you say resonates with me as a parent of a 14-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son, and that's why I'm so grateful to hear what it is that you're doing, because I believe it is the most important work. But, you know, something that we parents are facing, it's not just assessment every year. It's assessment almost every week. We parents need to be online watching grade after grade of our children and then somehow feel obliged to step in if 1 month they're not doing what they should be doing. And I kid you not. It's
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
What's up with that?
I see, in the beginning, here on the East Coast in particular, where the opt-out movement really got underway, the whole idea was to send a message that we wouldn't put up with this incredible evaluation each spring and the pressures that it involved. And everyone thought that, well, then they'll all go away. And they haven't gone away. It's gotten worse because now we have what's called CBE, which is really computer-based education. And as you said, every day these youngsters are logging on to blue screens, okay, to tablets in school, to computers in school, and they're being evaluated not once a day, but perhaps three or four times a day. And that's where that is happening now. I mean, the measurement is no longer just this test in the spring for language arts and for mathematics, okay? But it's every single day, and perhaps several times a day, that these kids are being evaluated. And parents like you have a right to be totally alarmed, because it has run joy and innocence right out of the classroom. And this is why you're seeing some kids coming home with these empty faces and these angry attitudes. And I can't blame the children. And to a certain degree, I can both blame and not blame the teachers who are caught in this predicament of having to push this stuff.
Okay, well, may I add to that, our high schools now have wellness centers to deal with suicidal and depressed teens.
Yeah.
And that budget is almost the same budget as the art program. There's something really wrong with our system.
Wow,
really?
Right?
Maybe there's a reason they're feeling suicidal and depressed. But yeah, I mean, so you're telling us that there's incredible pressure, I mean, day by day on these kids. And I mean, is this new? Has this always been the case? When did it start to change and why?
No, it has not always been the case. It started to change. Well, first of all, it started to change, you know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, okay? And then they were in the search for remedies to rectify what they saw as something that was wrong. And this is where Common Core really lost its bearing, was they began to make these generalized statements about the quality of education in America. I never quite understood when people said American schools are dreadful. I mean, here we are. We are the most favored and powerful nation on the planet. We have the greatest economy. People are jumping fences to come into our country. We are not jumping fences to get out of our country. And yet the mantra was, our public schools are all failing. Well, they weren't all failing, okay? What was failing was select schools, particularly inner city schools, okay, which have, of course, are populated largely by minorities. Those schools are in distress. But this Common Core reform, which could have performed miracles for those youngsters, for those minority students, that reform lost its nerve because it didn't have the gumption and the courage to say, this is where our problem is, in the inner cities for the most part. And so consequently, they had this sweeping reform, and they asked that it be distributed across America to every single district, whether the district was successful or not. And so now we have inequality of sadness going on. Everyone is unhappy with education, not just the inner city kids who really needed the rescue from the reform, but now they have bleached out and ruined some suburban schools as well that were performing very well. So this has been an equal opportunity reform of misery for school districts of all sorts, when it should have been a reform for inner city schools for the most part.
You're listening to Take Back the Universal Loves to Laugh here at 102.3 FM in San Rafael. We're listening to Dennis Ian. He's a retired school teacher turned writer, to tell us what is going on with our school systems and why we may not have it right. Dennis, I wanted to ask you, you touched on a real important moment, words about measurement. Like, how do we measure schools? And I wonder if that is part of the problem. I mean, how do we measure a child's success? How do we measure their failures? I mean, I'll be the first to raise my hand and say, you know what? My childhood failures are the things that I try to approach as an adult, because I learned from those failures. They were actually successful failures that have equipped me for dealing with life today. And now you couldn't get a school to agree with that, because that would be a burden on them. But how do we deal with this labeling of success or not success?
All right, let's speak about measuring for a moment here. Of course we can measure certain levels of proficiency, okay, in a child. We can give them a math exam, an evaluation instrument of some sort, and we can devise, you know, whether or not the child is competent or not, okay? However, when it comes to the whole total package of learning, okay, this idea of measuring with any degree of accuracy is a little ludicrous. There are things in life that can never be measured. Mm. Love. We can't measure love. Yeah. We can't measure courage. We can't measure curiosity. And yet, you know, we write books about love because people are still trying to somehow measure what it is and how you define it. And it cannot be defined. And I don't think that all of education can be defined, because it's a human activity. Yeah. And it's an interactive activity. And the idea that it can be reduced to some evaluative instrument, to some testing situation, where you get a digit or two or three or four at the end, that is a reflection of what has transpired, I think that's ludicrous. Yeah. So on the face of it all, to rely on these instruments and these digits that arrive as the result of these testing evaluations, I mean, there's a certain false, a false favor that's involved there. It just doesn't work that way. Not real education, because real education is a human activity, and it involves relationships. There are certain core relationships in every society: husband to wife, father to son, okay, teacher to student. These things are never going to change. They're as old as mankind itself. But yet we're on this whole measuring scheme, and as you said, it's wreaking havoc on elementary school children. I mean, we're seeing kids over medicated. We're seeing high schoolers with intervention centers. Okay, yeah. We're beginning to look like some of our Asian counterparts, who incidentally are now moving away from their own testing experience. The Chinese and the Japanese are saying enough is enough, and they're moving backwards, and we're moving and taking their place in this madness.
And I remember the very day I came to that realization, exactly what you said. I was standing in my son's first grade class. They were all eagerly getting logged on to their own individual iPads, which we as parents should have been excited about, because they had the budget for individual iPads for these first grade boys and girls. And as I stood there in the classroom watching all of these children become stressed out because they couldn't figure out how to push these little buttons in order to log in with this code and that code, and the teachers were running around and the other parents were trying to run around and kids were crying, and I sat back and I just observed the entire thing with this gut feeling that this is wrong. I can't intellectualize it or even articulate why I feel this way, but my gut is telling me it's wrong. And finally, after about 45 minutes, when the kids got settled down, looking at their little tiny screens with headphones, all individually, quietly doing their whatever, pushing their buttons for the little cartoon characters, and I kid you not, I looked up at the teacher, who was standing in a corner by herself, all relaxed, sipping her cup of coffee, and I asked her very carefully, because I knew I would be alarming the way that I really felt, I'll tell you, because I felt it was wrong. And I just said, why are we doing it this way? And she looked at me and she says, oh, this way we can measure their success. And I thought, really? And she said, this way we can send that information to the state in order to get funding. And I thought, oh my God, we're changing the way that we teach our children. We are child abuse. I would have called that child abuse, in order to get money, in order to look California distinguished. And that's how I measured it up. And that day, I walked out of that classroom and swore that I would go back to graduate school. And that is why I am here today with you right now, Dennis, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Because I can't thank you enough for really writing what you're writing. It's so important. Continue on, like, okay, so Common Core, going across the United States, everyone fitting into this one bucket. why are we trying to fit kids into one bucket, one measured bucket?
Well, the impetus behind Common Core was this. First of all, was that one of the most silly logistical explanation was that, well, we have a very mobile population. The kids pull up and move each year. So many kids move from one state to another, or from one school district to another, and whatnot. It's such a weak argument. It's ludicrous. I mean, the number that actually goes through that sort of activity is very, very slender. So that was the first argument that was put out there. And then the whole idea was, well, gee whiz, shouldn't a child who lives in Bangor, Maine, you know, be exposed to the same educational pathway as somebody who lives in San Diego, California? And the answer is, yeah, to a certain degree, perhaps, yes, but not necessarily all the way, okay? Because the people who live in Bangor, Maine have a much different lifestyle and a much different, you know, temperament than the people who live in San Diego, you follow?
Yeah.
But that didn't seem to matter to anybody. They all wanted these kids stuffed into the same can, okay? All neatly spaced out and what with one and, you know, between themselves and so forth. And they were going to be served up the same smorgasbord of education, whether they liked it or not, okay? Whether it's their particular regional appetite or not. It was all going to be the same. That was the original game plan behind Common Core, and that's why the word common, to make it a common experience from coast to coast, from the northern border to the southern border. And of course, it was a one-size-fits-all application, and it is dreadful. It's dreadful in its concept. It's more dreadful in its installation, and it's more dreadful in the fact that there are people out there keeping this already dead, dying reform on, you know, on resuscitation machines. It is a dying reform, and the people behind it will not quit. Bill Gates will not quit. There are others who will not give in, claiming we've already spent $1 billion, so let's spend several billion dollars more to keep the misery going so that everyone can have an equal dose of misery. It doesn't make any sense anymore.
And what's interesting,
it's a big country. It's 300 million people. What are you going to do?
Well, it's
you're
big business,
isn't it? You're going to homogenize education for the entire population?
And it's big business, $60 billion industry for technology. I mean, once you get your hands on that, how do you walk out? I mean, this is big business. Nicholas Kadaris writes a great book called Glow Kids, and it's about technology-based education and the harm that it's doing to our children, you know, certainly homogenizing them even more. I appreciate what you just said about Bill Gates. What the heck? Why is he involved in education? Because you have money, you suddenly have a voice, and therefore all of the things that you do are somehow granted, you know, successful? I'm not sure about that. How did we get here?
I can only speculate, and that is that he fancies himself an idle genius. He's made more money than he'll ever spend in 1,000 lifetimes. And somewhere along the line, he must have thought he had some sort of an epiphany, and that he was now going to assume the role of the educational messiah. And he was not alone. I mean, the Reed Hastings of Netflix is another. Even Rex Tillerson, who is now with the Trump administration, he was making pronouncements while he was a part of the Exxon Corporation. But these people have this enormous desire to change lanes, and one of the easiest lanes to get in, according to folks like this, seems to be the education. For some reason, everyone thinks they can teach, and it's based on the fact that they think they can teach because they were successful in teaching their own child to knot their shoes. But that qualifies them as a teacher. You follow?
I do, but the thing that I don't understand is Bill Gates' success. Okay, he made a lot of money. Is that successful? I'm not really sure it is, because he was also an incredible bully. In order to play business, you have to be a horrific bully. You don't play nice. You play to win, and that is not playing nice, and that's a problem that we have in our society right now. But more than that, let's look at Silicon Valley, for example. Many of the CEOs of the companies, of the tech businesses, are putting their own children, not in public schools, they're putting them into private Waldorf schools and getting their own children away from technology. Where is the sense in that? And are we the guinea pigs? Are we the guinea pigs with our children in public schools today?
Listen, that is perhaps my favorite word, guinea pig. I use that as a noun. I use it as a verb. It is exactly what has happened. I think we are in We are in a kind of sick sort of experiment that swerves and curves and takes all different sorts of turns. And I don't think that we are anywhere near the end of it all. Every day it seems people pop up and want to put a new sort of stamp on this and what's happening. And you're absolutely right. Those moguls, those rich folks, you know, the Reed Hastings, the Bill Gates, they shield their youngsters from the very same experience that they pour millions into, okay? And for some reason, they feel that it's very fine for them to practice regency over your own child, but not okay for you to practice any sort of educational regency over your own child. So I don't know where they get this attitude that they're the know-it-alls and we're the dummies, but that's exactly the feeling that goes around for anyone who pays attention to this sort of thing.
Well, this is power. That's what power is all about.
It is power.
Wait, yeah, there's a great line, right? If you own the history, I'm not going to get it right, but the idea is if you own the history, you own the power.
Right. And you know, these people have also, they have created the narrative, yes, of the failing public schools. They're the ones who have said, you know, these schools are a mess. Well, these schools are not a mess. Do we have messy schools? Yes, we do. But they are not the overwhelming number. You go down, America loves their local schools. They love their elementary schools. They love their middle schools. They adore their high schools. And if you go to the vast majority of communities across the country, they're more than very satisfied with their local public schools. The inner cities, they're a different story, okay? There are people down there who are exasperated, parents who are reaching out for any sort of salvation for their children, because the politics and the unionism of the inner city has simply spoiled that whole entire sort of educational experience. But the vast majority of American schools function well enough. Are they perfect? No, they're not. Should they always be in reform? All schools should be in a constant state of reform. You should never sit on your laurels.
What?
The school that I was with was forever saying, how can we get it better? How can we do it better? How can we make it all happen in a better fashion? And that is what we were doing. But now the reform has come in, and it has disassembled so much of what is good in addition to not curing what was bad.
And certainly we are in a new time period. We're at a time where self-reflection and criticism is probably going to help us to a great deal, given the environmental problems that we have, because we really have to look at education first when we look at these huge environmental problems that these kids are coming into. And one of the things that I always walked away from each day when I visited my daughter's school and looked at the work that she was doing was this: is this propagation to help her navigate a system that's been established that is hurting us, right? Consumerism, for example, you know, commercialization, you know, the understanding of more corporate logos and how to be a good buyer versus how many botanicals are growing in, or what kind of botanicals are growing in your own backyard, or even the tree outside your classroom. I mean, that's always my favorite question to the teachers. Oh, what kind of tree is that? We are so far away from just the basic connection to nature, which is, in my view, one of the first and foremost things to have, because, you know, there are many reasons for that. One of the things that Waldorf education does an extremely good job doing. I'm not going to say Waldorf is exceptional on every level in my view, but they do a few things really, really well. But it was really this question of what is education teaching the child today? Is it teaching the child to be a good worker, to get a good job, to make a lot of money? Or is it teaching them to be critical thinkers and good Democrats? I'm not saying Republican Democrats. I'm saying it to live in a democracy where you can make good choices. I don't know.
Yeah, listen, you made an interesting point a moment ago about the environment and you know, is school preparing youngsters for the environment they're going to step into? My problem with the schools also deals with the environment, but this is the issue that I'm more concerned about, and that is that schools are now separating children from their own environment. And by that I mean they're separating the children from joy, from their innocence, okay? And they are somehow revving up the whole maturing process, not only academically, but sexually even to a certain degree. And I have a real problem when we want to make 60 and 70 month old children, okay, behave way beyond the number of months that they have lived on the planet. We're not careful enough with their innocence. We're not careful enough with the joys of childhood. And we're now installing grit and rigor and all this other rot, okay, into the lives of these very, very small, sweet children who are brand new people. And the adults are polluting the environment of childhood. And that is a terrible way to kick off any sort of educational, circumstance that leads to anything worthwhile. I mean, there was a reason why youngsters used to hold hands and move around in circles and play falling down and sing songs and giggle with one another, because that was all healthy stuff. Now it's looked at as something that's in the way of this purpose called education, and that's a serious business. And the whole idea is, let's get rid of all the unseriousness. So we get rid of recess, we get rid of songs, we get rid of play, we get rid of this and that. Mm-hmm. And what are we left with? We're left with a very unhappy situation for very young children, which is one of the reasons why you were stunned when you went to that classroom and you saw those children trying to log on to those machines. Machines are no fun. The child next to you is fun.
It broke my heart when I saw that. And, thank you for saying that about play and joy. I made a film called Racing with Copepods. It was an ocean advocacy film. And one of the things that I saw, and many organizations are involved in this, is Last Child in the Woods, Richard Louv, he's written a lot about that, is the essentialness and the power behind allowing children that freedom to play, to explore, to find their own way too, to listen to themselves, right, to their own voice.
Yeah.
They're very powerful models for children, and play is one of the most essential. And when you love something with play, you grow to love what it is that you're doing, that becomes power later, because you want to protect what it is that you love. And in my film, it was about sailing, where we didn't teach them how to race and be competitive. We just got them out on boats to play and enjoy the water, which turned into become a very powerful model of loving the water and wanting to protect it as well, which many of the kids have gone on to doing some great things. But yet, why have we made play such a superfluous
thing? There was the one moment, well, not the one, but one of the moments of great epiphany for me as a teacher came about 30 years ago when I read a book by a fellow whose first name escapes me, but he was an Ivy Leaguer. Elkin was his last name, and the name of the book was called The Hurried Child. And the hurried child has never gone away, and he's only hurried up. And by that I mean he's... That whole situation described by Elkin was, why are we revving up education for these children? Why are we revving up their childhood? And he spoke of this, 30 years ago, and here we are, three decades later or more, and we're not only doing more of it, we're doing it in more hurtful ways. And I don't understand why this assault on childhood. I just do not get it. And of all the reasons that I'm part of this I don't know if you want to call it resistance or information, whatever. But one of the reasons why I'm here is because I'm a champion of children. I think children are, if it's not about children, I'm really not very much interested. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have no sympathy for unions. I have no sympathy for administrators. I have less sympathy even for teachers. Okay. If it's not about children, I'm not as much interested. Okay, if you're tied to the situation of children, then I'm interested. But this whole idea of the hurried child and what are we doing, I think we do need to examine ourselves and And we should have a real national self-examination on what we're doing to children.
Maybe it's the adults who need to be happy, right? Maybe the children's happiness just reminds us adults how unhappy we are and how crazy we've become. I think there's some truth to that, because I look around me and I just see so many unhappy adults. You know, where's the joy in our lives, you know, dancing and music and just letting go? We've become
an obsession. I'll tell you where the happiness in your life really is. Yeah, the happiness in life is hanging out with little people, okay? Go sit on the floor with a bunch of kids, okay? You'll have the time of your life, okay? You know, sit around a fire, you know, with making s'mores. I don't care if the child's 16 years old or 6 years old. You're going to have a blast. We don't do that anymore. We're observers rather than part of the whole circus, the whole beautiful circus of childhood. We seem to be observers. And I don't know what's going on in this country. We seem to hand our children over to these people, and we say to them, I'll teach them what they need to know and what they need to think and what they need to feel, you know? And you're not supposed to do that. They're teachers, you know? You're supposed to, there's a certain role for teachers to play and a certain role for parents to play. But they've handed it all over to the schools, it seems. So now we teach them everything in schools, from how to brush their teeth to how to take a test, okay, how to not bully, you know, how to put the beer down and, you know, don't smoke the joint and don't go too fast in the car. Those are things that used to be done at home, for goodness sakes. Now we ask our schools to do all of these things. And it starts very young, you know. Parents don't seem to, they seem to want to pass things off.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think part of the narrative is just becoming so misconstrued, because I know I'm going through this craziness too, and there's a band of us parents who our voice just isn't heard. And my angle has been, at least with my daughter's school right now, because I think, see, this is where the voice needs to be elevated, is technology, how it is dominating the high school scene. I mean, listen to this. I went in for the first open house this year. My daughter just started high school at a good school, right? That's what I've been told. This is what I believed. And one of the teachers showed us how he introduced the children to one another. And they were each required to take out their phone devices. So, of course, now each has to have a phone device. I'm not kidding you. And they have to download an app. Okay? And, you know, so that takes time. And then they put in information about themselves. And then they look up at a screen that's projected above them to learn each other's names and what their favorite color is, or, you know, some little basic fact about them. There is no eye contact. There is no recognition of one another. And this is all done to this backdrop of 70s music, because the teacher thought it was really cool and that'll get the kids excited. So they did this experiment on us adults. Now, I don't have an iPhone. I actually have a flip phone. I do this on purpose, which actually some other tech people in Silicon Valley are doing, because they've realizing technology has taken over our lives and they want to become human again. There was a great article in the paper just recently about this. And so I just sat there and observed all the parents do this, and I thought, oh my gosh, so now these tech devices have become kind of the new automobiles of who's cool and who's not, you know, or whatever, however you want to measure that up.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a device, you're kind of out of the game. And not only that, but these devices have become a big part of the educational they have to have devices now, you know, and it's amazing to me how everything is construed around this. Even the communication between the school and me, it's all on technology. I cannot walk into an office and talk to anybody. It's amazing to me. And for me, that we're human. We have lost our connection. That's what community is, isn't it? Isn't that where I get to look at a person and know who they are and who they are as a person? I mean, there's nobody to go to anymore. unless you want to scream, and which is I'm screaming now into the airwaves with you. It's where are the people who care? That's what I'm asking.
I get this, you know, I have a brother who lives in Florida, who sent me an email about a month ago. He said, the strangest thing happened to me last night is I went out to dinner with Joe, his wife, and he said, and at the next table over with three children and a mother and father, and not one cell phone, and they were actually speaking to one another.
Wow. Now, that's an odd sight.
That was the unusual rather than the norm. That was the it was so unusual. He took note of it and yeah. said, you know, I know this is the sort of thing that you would find amusing. I didn't find it very amusing. I found it a little shocking that was now the unusual.
Well, there's a school near here actually, and I had the principal, the founder of the school, on radio a few months back. And one of the things that she said, and I thought, wow, this is really the case, is that when schools sanction technology and the use of it, that means it's okay outside the school too. You're setting the example. You know, you are setting the example of what is right and what is wrong. And we all have to really own up to this, even the parents. I mean, and you know, I'm on a computer, certainly, too, social media, so I have to own up to that. We all do, right? How are we all behaving and showing our kids how to behave? But it has become a crisis at this stage.
I have to tell you something that, we are in, it's like a technological avalanche the last 8-10 years. I mean, it has all come so quickly from so many angles and with such hype. And that school districts are out there, and they're not unlike people. You know, my own sons, you know, I mean, something new comes out, they've got to buy this stuff, you know? And they're in their 30s and 40s, you follow?
Yeah.
And they've got to buy these new technologies just because they're the new stuff. But schools are the same way, and I even remember back when I was teaching how much technology would arrive at the school with such hype and fanfare, only to sit on the curbs a few weeks later, and no one ever used it the way it was intended to be used. In other words, it was bought with the school district personnel saying to the public, look at how modern we are, look at how cutting edge we are, and so forth. Well, the cutting edge was the cutting edge of the curb because no one was using it. And today, it's happening even more quickly. It arrives every day in new forms. And now you have to take these tests online in many states, okay? And all this stuff is being recorded. It's one big data blob. Everything is being warehoused in central information centers, and God knows what they have on your 10 and 14-year-old. They probably have more information than you care to know.
My daughter told me the other day, she says, Mom, did you know if you put a photo of me on your Facebook page, I could sue you later in life? I thought, oh my goodness. Okay, I'm not going to go there. You know, did you hear the other story? I think it was a mother on the East Coast where a kindergarten class was trying to use technology. The mother was saying no, and the school was coming after her with child protective services. Wow, oh my gosh. Really?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If we question the school system, it backfires on us now as parents. That's where we're at.
I have to tell you something. If you're a parent, one of the hardest jobs today in this country is being a parent, because you have to explain yourself to people, like principals, that this is your child and you don't want something to happen to this particular child. You don't want this experience for your child. And I can't believe that you have to act like a barrister, a lawyer, in order to protect your child from some of the weirdness that these people want to install in their educational programs.
And the irony of this is they've only got the kid for 4 years in high school. I got the kid my entire life, so I got to be true to the child. They get to step out in four years.
Once they're your kids forever, man. They don't ever go away.
Oh, gosh. Okay, so where's the hope? I mean, so there's a lot of charter schools that are arising now. Charter schools, I know in Marin County, there's been big backlash. But I will tell you, my son is in a charter school up in Northern California right now, and it's a great program. No technology, or maybe they use a little bit here and there, but two dogs in the classroom to buddy up with the kids. It's beautiful. They sit next to the dogs when they read on the floor. A lot of nature education. There's a lot of good here that's brewing. Where's other hope? Where do you see it?
I think there is this backlash that will continue about this one-size-fits-all reform. I just think that The reform is unraveling. It's coming apart. I really believe that, okay? People don't want to admit it out loud, but it's happening. And what I see now, and a friend of mine in upstate New York whose daughter goes to this wonderful academy up there, a very small one, she says that people, schools up her way are actually advertising that they're anti-Common Core, that they don't follow Common Core.
Yeah.
And that's the attraction, okay? Can you imagine? That's your billboard to come to my school, we don't do Common Core. And I think what you're going to see over the next few years is you're going to see a resurgence of private schools. I think you're going to see what your child has experienced. I think charter schools are certainly going to grow in number, and there are going to be successes there, and there are going to be failures in charter schools. I mean, that's just the way it is. I think you're going to see a continued growth in homeschooling. It's up over the last several years by pretty significant margins. And I think we're going to see some school districts who are eventually going to say, you know what, I don't want to be a part of this reform business anymore. And we're going to shove off from the beach, and we're going to sail on our own boat and do our own thing. And I think what's going to happen is, believe it or not, we're going to go and we're going to swim right back to where we were 25 or 30 years ago, but with a brand new sort of awareness that we can't make the same errors that we made 25 or 30 years ago. So I really think that the local school district, the neighborhood school, they are going to survive this mess. And I think it's all going to go full circle, because eventually these gurus, you know, these big money people and these politicians like Cuomo and Deal down in Georgia and a few others who have made their name on this, they're going to go away, because they're going to be told, they've been told time and time to leave, to get out of the way, that they're more of a problem than they are a solution.
Yeah, and I appreciate you raising the topic about private schools, because this is something I don't understand. We don't bat an eye, really, about private schools. I mean, they're there, people have to pay the money to get in. But those are the people who have the money to pay the private schools, which go for, let me be mindful of this, $30,000 a year, at least here in Marin County, and probably more in other places too. So we don't question the fact that if a person has money, then they get the choice. But what if a person doesn't have money? Where is my choice? You know, some people say, oh, you can get, you know, scholarships. I don't want a scholarship. I want to be able to have a choice. And why is it that I don't get to have that choice if I don't have that 30 grand a year? But a child who does come from a family who can afford that gets the choice. I mean, I think, and I'm going to say it, I do think Trump has a point here. I really have to say it. And believe me, this is a hard thing for me to say. Very, very hard. You know, and I'm going to say, I don't think he nor Betsy DeVos are really the people to solve the problem. But I do think it is a legitimate question that the system is a mess. And that's a time for us to question, why do we not have more choices? And people who don't have the money have the choices.
Yeah, I think people have misread President Trump and also Betsy DeVos, and I'll tell you why. Trump, more than anything, is a disturber. I don't know if he's a man of solutions for a lot of things, but I will tell you that he's a disruptor of the status quo. And if you look at his first year, he's done nothing but shake this place up. Betsy DeVos, her particular area is education. She is the disturber there. He hired her to keep the disturbing going on, and she is doing just that. And people are losing their brains over Betsy DeVos. It's such wasted anger, it's such wasted anxiety to do that over Betsy DeVos, because what Betsy DeVos's message is very simple. We need to rescue certain segments of this society from their educational hell. Okay? Mm-hmm. So where are the solutions? And these other people who are against her are digging their heels in and saying, well, what we have is working fine. Well, it's not working fine in Detroit. It's not working fine in Chicago. It's not working fine in New York City. It's not working fine in a whole host of other cities like Baltimore or Philadelphia, places like that. But she's disturbing the whole situation. Now the question is, okay, so now she's shaking things up. What do we do about it? That's where the real issue is. Remains to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah, and we were talking about homeschooling before the show today, and you had mentioned that it's been on the rise, right?
The what?
Homeschooling has actually been on the
rise. Homeschooling has been, pretty significantly, yes.
Yeah.
Listen, they outperform their counterparts in scoring, in college placement, and so forth, and they have great. They seem to have the right balance in education, you know.
Yeah.
They're not sitting in desks. They're not following, listening to bells all day. They follow the cadence of the real world rather than some prison-like atmosphere where the bells ring every 52 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever it is, and they get up like little mice and go to the next bit of the maze, you know.
I had the privilege to homeschool my own daughter from, I guess it was first grade until fifth grade, and it was, for me, the most amazing experience to engage in that with her, because we had a very tight community here in Marin County, a small group of families, maybe about 8 or 9, a few came in and left and so forth during that time period. But you know what was really the most beautiful thing about it? We engaged teachers who loved to teach, but gave them the freedom to teach as they wanted to teach. You know, we saw what they were doing, and then we hired them, and we didn't sit there and tell them what to do and how to do it. And it really gave them that sense of freedom to engage the students on that very passion level, which was amazing and beautiful.
I'm laughing because you're describing education the way it was 20 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's the way it was.
Let me tell you.
20 years ago, everyone said to the teacher, how do we do this? How do we get it done?
Yeah.
You know? Now they're the last person to be asked, you know? And it's a shame because it's those other people. And I spoke with you prior to this. I said, they're driving these master teachers out of the profession.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, they're running, and they're packing their stuff up, and they're taking all of their knowledge, all of their wisdom with them right out the door, and we're left with these people like you describe, who stand in the corner and wait for the computers to break down or to help someone with their login. You know, that's not a teacher, that's a custodian.
Yeah, and let me tell you the power behind that. My daughter transferred to a California Distinguished School after 4 years of homeschooling, a lot of nature education, 7 hours of academics a week, and I'm not kidding you, you know, based on what the California standards required us to do, because we, you know, we followed that. It was pretty simple. 7 hours, you can do it in 7 hours a week. And she scored in the top percentile when she transferred to her new public school. I was very quickly shut down. I mean, it was, you know, they did not want to acknowledge that at the school.
I
became the villain. And I graciously tried not to, you know, insert myself too much in the school. And I honestly, this is what I told my daughter. This was her education. When she went to school that first day of school, I said, honey, you just got the best education a kid could possibly get. I believe you can go walk into this middle school and do everything by yourself without my telling you to do anything, and graduate on a good, great level. And you know what? I owned that, and she did it. And that was her education, that she can do it by herself.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, listen, I tell you, the one thing that scares the heck out of lots of people in the professional class in education is success, particularly if that success comes in a different way than what they prescribe. You follow?
Yeah.
So when you're having a success with your child, homeschooling the child, and then that's scary. That bothers them. You know, it should delight them instead. You know, because what's the aim is? It's supposed to be all about children, but too many adults make it all about them. That's what's wrong, you follow?
Yes.
Politicians make it all about them. Administrators make it all about them. These gurus who will fly around the country saying, do this, do this, do that, they make it all about them. But you know who it's all about? It's all about the children. It's about the kids. That's who it's all about. All of these other people, they're just you know, circumstantial players, because it's really about children, and that's what everyone loses. Everyone loses that focus all the time.
Yeah. We all just need to get outside and play. That's what we all need to do.
We do.
And see, maybe the adults need to get into those circles and sing those songs.
I gotta tell you something. There is nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong in early education, and even in upper education. There is nothing wrong with silliness. There's nothing wrong with stepping outside the lines, or coloring outside the lines, or You know, I regularly, as a teacher, I used to do the unconventional just because the routine was so exasperatingly boring.
Yeah.
And I would shake things up sometimes because it so desperately needed to be shaken up. And now we are creating this experience that we call education that is dreadfully boring, dreadfully predictable, dreadfully evaluating all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was a child, I mean, I don't know what, I'd be going crazy. I would be crazy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, I'm so happy that people like you are out in the world. Also, you know, you're shaking things up on a level that it's also certainly speaking to those of us who see that there's a problem, but we don't know how to approach it, or you know, we question our own sanity. I mean, believe me, there were days where I'd just sit there at the playground looking at issues and going, this doesn't feel right, but nobody heard me, at least at that school. But when I exited that school and talked to other people, they'd say, oh, yeah, you know, we understand and we agree with you. And it's about really uniting those voices and questioning. And
there were just too many timid parents out there. Too many people who think, well, it's not my place to speak up. It's not my place to offer an opinion about what would benefit my child or whatnot. And because they've all heard stories of being of parents being, you know, beaten down, hacked up, and you know, told to shut up. And it's terrible that we have drawn these particular battle lines, you know, with administrators and teachers and so forth, and parents, and it's just not right. We should all be in it together, and we're in it for the kids, okay?
Yes.
And when they become the focus, and everybody else agrees that they're more important than unions, they're more important than principals, they're more important than teachers, and they're more important than politicians or any other outfit that wants to make money off of this process, when everyone agrees on that particular principle, then we'll start to get things right.
You're listening to Dennis Ian. He's a retired teacher, lives in New York, and is taking on the educational topic internationally, right? Your articles are being shared in Australia.
Yes, there are
pools
all over the globe.
Wow. Clearly, your opinion, your voice, it's resonating with many others who are all, including me, who are just grappling at this issue and wondering, are we going crazy or is it the schools? And hey, you know, there are enough people like you, and I hope people who are listening to this program get inspired enough to reach out and start asking questions. And, you know, as always, it's also good to find out what the positive route is. You know, going back to Coleridge School here in Marin County, the principal, she actually had got so fed up with public school after 20 years. She says, you know what? The thing needs to collapse before it gets better. And maybe one way is to create a new model, which she has done herself, which is incredibly courageous. And incredibly, you know, that is a risk. Starting your own school, that is a huge risk. And but you got the funding, you got the trust, you got so many things that can go wrong. And she's been doing it and trying to create a model that works for our children today in this new age that we're all dealing with. And that, you know, to me, that's being a risk taker and that's being courageous, much of like what you're doing as well, you know.
Well, I agree. I think we need pioneers. I mean, that sounds like a silly word, but I think we do need pioneers. I think we need people who are going to go out there and be willing to try this and try that, and also for other people to put up with a little bit of failure. We tried this and it didn't work. Well, that's the way it goes. Sometimes you need to have a failure or two or three before you have some sort of really grand achievement. But yeah, I think that what we've got now, I think, has to go through a period of failure, and I think we're in that period of failure. I really do.
Yeah.
I think there is great disenchantment from coast to coast. Certainly, the inner cities are starting to moan and groan, and there's a certain level of anger there, and the suburban folks, I think, are waking up and saying, you know what, we're spending a pile of money on this reform, and it does no good.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anyone any good at all.
That's a great way. I mean, failure can be a success, and not to be afraid of failure, right? I mean, we're all so afraid of that word, but gosh, isn't that your greatest asset in so many ways?
I tell you, you know, for schools, schools are one of the only places on the planet where it is okay to fail. Okay? You know, it's the one place where you're allowed to fail, where you're allowed to mess up. That's the whole principle behind schools, is that children take dares there, and they learn certain lessons, and they fail, and then they get up, and they try again. But it's an institution designed not only for success, but also to accommodate a certain level of failure. And because that's part of the process.
Right, right. And not to be afraid of that.
No, not to.
Yeah. So I'm just going to laugh the next time I fail at something. You learn so much from that. I mean, maybe it should be a different word. Maybe that's what we could work on. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. But this has been really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could find a softer word than failure, you know. But it's not a bad word.
Yeah.
At least not in my. I mean, I made a habit of failing. I fail all the time. I'm very good at that.
Maybe that's what,
you know,
that's
I have a real talent for failure.
Janet, it's been such a pleasure to have you on this show, and as we grapple with the topic of education, and, you know, isn't it fun to, like, solve the world's problems on air and, like, talk them out? And I think we just came up with the solutions, right? Now just everyone needs to listen to you, and we'll
all get it right. Well, I tell you, you know, talking with you, it beats pounding this keyboard at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning.
It's a lot more fun. Right. I mean, there it goes again. I mean, I think I had a little outburst this morning at my screen. The screen gets used to me yelling at it, you know, but it's so much more fun to yell with somebody else. But you do, by doing that, you also come up with some solutions and get inspired too. And I'm totally inspired by your work. And just thank you. Where can people read your writing? Do you have a blog or something?
Yes, I do. Michelle Moore, who's a dear friend of mine, has pushed me into this blog business, okay? And she's more or less taking control of it. I just write down all the silly words, and then she puts them all in proper clothing. But the name of the blog, it's called Dennis Ian Blog. That's Dennis with one N, Dennis Ian Blog, .wordpress.com. And that's where folks can find me, under that Dennis Ian blog. And things I've written there and on a variety of issues there, but mostly it's educational stuff.
Yeah, you even wrote an open letter to Donald Trump, who will be visiting our place here in Northern California.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of anybody.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, no fear, fearless, being fearless. Okay, well, we're running out of time, and I just really want to say again, Dennis Ian, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to have you back on air another time. Let's count on doing that another time when we can talk about education.
Well, I had a wonderful time, too. Thank you very much.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you again, and I'll be in touch with you soon. Again, that was Dennis Ian. He's DennisIanBlog.com. Did I have that right? DennisIanBlog.com?
Yes, blog. DennisIanBlog.wordpress.com.
Got it. And that information will also be on my own webpage at BarbaraMcVeigh.com. And you can listen, you can read more information about this show and listen to it again on that site. Really, we wanted to move on to a couple of other topics before we leave the show today. Northern California, wow, just 30 minutes north of where I am sitting right now, we have a big fire, lots of big fires that have been happening over the last few days. I just really want to reach out to so many people out there right now who have been enduring such loss and fear and so much more, is that we are feeling for you. And I know Marin County has really taken a big stand in support networks and so and other things. So just really want to feel for our neighbors up north during this time. On to more issues. Let's see. Next week, next Tuesday night, I wanted to point out my television program, which is called People's Environmental News, which airs on cmcmtv.net. We're going to have Resilient Neighborhood with Tamara Peters, who's going to talk to us about carbon footprints and how we can take a better responsibility with the way that we are conducting our lives as we deal with some big issues at hand. And just really want to thank all of you for listening with us today, 102.3 FM or radio.dominican.edu. Here at Take Back, the Universe Loves to Laugh on Penguin Radio, Dominican University of California. A big thank you to our executive director, Stuart Horn. Thank you so much for all that you do for us here at Penguin Radio. And that's it for today, folks. We'll catch you next week. Have a great week.